Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Brian Laffin, and we're back with a new episode of Stream Close Up, the podcast where we talk to the creative forces behind the great shows that you're watching on your streaming services. We took a little break, but moving forward, you can expect new episodes on a regular basis. Today, we're very happy to welcome as our guest, actor, writer, director, husband, and father, Alexander Kareem. Alex is the lead in the new pan-Scandinavian drama Advokaten, playing the lawyer Frank Nordling opposite Malin Buska. Alex has worked around the world in film and television. For 3 seasons, he had a key role on the FX series Tyrant. Alex has played opposite Nicolas Cage in Dying of the Light and made a small appearance in the Oscar-winning film Zero Dark Thirty. Among other roles, Alexander was the lead in the recent reboot of the beloved Swedish classic Jönssonligan, and he's also known for his reoccurring role in the Johan Falk franchise and as being a regular on the Arne Dahl miniseries. Alex will tell us about those experiences and his journey from Helsingborg to Hollywood and back. He'll talk about his unusual method and how film and television became a family business for Alex and his brothers. In for his Stream Close-Up, Alexander Kareem. Okay, everything you say now can and will be held against you in a court of law, Advokaten. Welcome to the show, Alexander Kareem.
Thank you so much.
Alexander is out doing the work, promoting his latest project, Advokaten, which is premiering right now on Viaplay. Alexander has the responsibility of being the star of the new project, and he does it with ease and grace, I have to say, Advokaten. I've had the pleasure of watching the first 4 episodes.
And wow.
I'm hooked. I'm in.
Fantastic.
All the way. Before we get to the work and talking about Advokaten, as we like to do, we want to hear a little bit about your background.
Sure.
As I understand it, you grew up in Helsingborg.
I did.
How do you go from a guy growing up in Helsingborg to someone who's playing in some of the biggest films of all time, small parts, but big films, working in the UK, the US, and all over Scandinavia?
Right.
What's the evolution?
Well, I think it started off with me being, I mean, we lived in Helsingborg and we lived in a very well-off neighborhood. We didn't have a lot of money, but we lived in sort of the, on the right side of the track, quote unquote. But, and growing up with those kids, I was ours was the only black family in that part of the city. And so you had to adopt. I mean, you adopt certain traits and certain ways of behaving. I mean, all the kids that I grew up with, sort of sons and daughters of wealthy businessmen and so on and so forth. And so you just start acting. You start play acting them. Kind of a thing. And then on the other hand,
Hang on. Are you aware? When did you become aware that you're play acting then? That must be something you see in retrospect, or you're aware while you're doing it?
No, you're aware while you're doing it because they're not eating their food the way you eat your food at home.
Uh-huh.
So right off the bat, you're like, all right, so what do I do in this situation? And you start sort of adapting to that.
You're studying, you're taking on
your
traits,
study,
you're acting.
Exactly, uh-huh. Exactly. Subjects, things to talk about, and so on and so forth. And then, but on the other side of the tracks were my other buddies, because I've done martial arts most of my life. And my martial arts buddies, that's a whole other sort of I mean, some would call it the ghetto of Helsingborg, but it's not, this is Sweden.
All ghettos
it's
are
not,
relative.
Yeah, exactly. And to hang out there, you start behaving in a certain way. And so that's how I got into sort of, I think that's how the whole chameleon, the thing of changing and like the shape shifting idea comes into play.
Zelig.
Exactly. And then also we just watched a ton of movies. That was our escape. I mean, our friends went off to ski in the Alps, or they went to Switzerland, and they went everywhere for their spring breaks and everything. And we couldn't afford that, so we traveled, but in the world of cinema.
And when you say we, you're talking about your brothers here?
My brothers and my sister and my mom.
And your brothers and your sister, they're in the business as well?
Both my brothers are. Both your brothers. Yeah, they're directors.
They're directors, okay.
Yeah.
I see that you've done some work with your brother Baker, is it?
Exactly. And also I've done some work with Osman, my other brother, but Baker mostly.
So the family has emerged from this experience to work as storytellers on both
Absolutely.
Sides of the camera.
Yeah. I mean, growing up in a Ugandan household, storytelling is a part of what you do. I mean, it's a storytelling culture. Sitting around telling stories to this day, I don't know what the weather was like when I was born because it keeps shifting. I don't know what the conditions were like. I mean, on one day it could be crocodiles cried on the day and that's good luck. And there was this storm that came in and we knew that was a good omen. And the next time you hear about it was a sunny day and you came out and you were out and nobody even noticed. And, it's, everything shifts depending on the mood.
As long as you're still in the story.
I'm still in the story. But you go from being,
It's interesting. We had Malin Buska up, your co-star from Advokatina, and she talked about how storytelling was important to her culture growing up north of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
How that was also, that's the genesis of her becoming an actress. Perfect that you two find each other in this project.
Yeah.
So you go from being a chameleon and someone who's way into film. When you say way into film, what stuck out? What do you remember from being a kid? What resonates still? Who are the heroes? Who are the people you wanted to emulate on screen?
Star Wars was our first sort of, because we had a reel. Before the VCR showed up, we had like an 8mm projector. And on that, we had a 12-minute synopsis version of Star Wars, the first one.
Cool.
The whole thing boiled down to 12 minutes. And we used to watch that, rewind. And then came all the classics.
And by the way, for you kids listening, this is pre-binge watching. We had to work to watch things over and over.
Yeah, there was no binge. There was binge eating, but there was no binge watching back in those days. But I mean, and then from there, we went on to the classics. When the VCR showed up, we had Ben-Hur and we watched the Ten Commandments, which.
Okay. Film study for real.
Definitely. Citizen Kane, all the classics, Butch Cassidy. But then came, because my mom has kind of an odd film taste. She loves the old sea movie, like the really terrible horror movies.
Okay.
Zoltan, Hound of Dracula.
Okay, where you see the special effects strings.
Exactly.
There's a charm to that filmmaking as well.
I love it. So we got it all. I mean, we got highs and lows and we watched everything, just everything.
And as a result, you guys are all in the business. That's fascinating, actually.
Yeah.
So you're a self-made actor. Did you go on to do any formal training as part of your journey?
Yeah, I turned 19 and I moved to LA and I went to LA Theater Academy.
Hang on, slow down now. You turn 19, you go to LA.
Yeah.
Are your brothers already there? Are you going on your own? Tell me.
No. Yeah. My brothers went to LA to study film. So they'd been living there for a while. And I was sort of, do I go to LA? New York is more of an actor's town, I guess, but they already lived there. And so I went to LA to join them there. And so I started studying theater. And sort of naturally, the natural progression of everything was they're directors and producers, and I'm an actor. Let's do stuff together. That's the way.
So who went first among your family?
Osman, my oldest brother.
Osman,
went.
So
yeah.
So he broke the ground for you guys.
He definitely did. I mean, he's 8 years older than I am. And so he went and he sent these makeup kits back to my middle brother, Baker, sort of the artist. And he sent these Rick... Do you remember Rick Baker?
Rick, the guy, the
makeup
horror
artist.
Film guy.
Oh, he's a makeup artist. He did the makeup for Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Oh, okay. And
he
did, yeah,
the greatest, some say the greatest makeup artist of all time. So he sent the Rick Baker makeup kit back to Baker. And for years and years, he used to like torture me with, I gotta try this burn thing on you. And he's doing all this makeup to make burn, like make me look like a burn victim or a gash over the forehead and scare all the parents and uncles and stuff like that. And so it was a constant sort of present. There was a constant presence of film and filmmaking in our lives.
So it was just a natural arc that you're heading into.
Oh, yeah,
this
yeah,
the
yeah,
whole
yeah.
Way.
We made movies at home movies. And
so what was the LA experience like for you?
I thought it was fantastic. I mean, I remember, and not even in retrospect. I mean, even when I was there, I remember one of my friends was depressed, and I used to always tell her, I used to say, Courtney, we're 19. We're actors in Hollywood. The world would give their right arm to be where we are right now. Like, there's no cooler place on the planet to
be. It's 22 degrees and sunshine. Let's go watch the sunset over Malibu. What's wrong?
Everything is perfect right now.
But again, if you're going there to pursue your dreams and it's not working out, I guess it can be heartbreaking for more people than it's successful.
Absolutely. But I mean, we were in school. She's 20 years old, and life was great.
Did you end up working in the States then before you came back in any parts or?
I did actually. Right after school, I got chosen to be in the Hudson Theater. It's an old, really nice, respected theater
in LA.
In LA, yeah. And I started auditioning, and I got two parts, two leads actually in two movies, and I didn't have a visa and I was trying to get that. And then I had to go back home and I was telling my agent, I was like, come on, let's just fix it somewhere. And then I went back home and they just never materialized.
Ouch. Yeah. Ouch. That must've hurt to have
it
something
did.
That close.
I mean, they were indies, of course. Okay. It's not like I got to, it wasn't Universal Studios knocking on my door.
Yeah,
is all I'm saying.
You have to start somewhere. It's credit.
Really
come
do.
On.
You really do. But and especially then, I preferred working here, starting off here and just doing shorts and actually playing the parts that you really want to do rather than chase a Taco Bell commercial for years and years and years.
A little bit of both. I guess, you know, as an artist, you have a vision for what you want to do, but you also want to work, so you can't always choose where it goes. It's nice when it lines up that you do get to do the things you like to do.
Exactly.
So you got a chance to work with your brother Baker in a couple of his productions early on to really refine your chops and find your voice.
Yeah. I mean, we had a project called Playground, which was, I mean, we had our projects that we wanted to make, big budget things and writing the scripts and stuff. But we also had this side project we called Playground, which was take the idea that you have and let's just go out and shoot it. And so we made lots and lots of little short films that had great success and won all kinds of awards and stuff like that and really became our sort of gateway to the business. But just the idea of doing something not on a schedule, not with a, you know, production coordinator with a whip, just having a line producer, just doing it for the fun of it and experimenting.
How are you guys financing it, to ask a boring question? I mean,
well, the first Playground production called Limelights was $10.
Excellent.
Half hour movie.
So an idea is more important than anything else.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's all we did. We just made these little short films. It was the DV, right when the DV camera started getting really good back in 2000. It was good times.
And then you transition, you start to appear sort of in the Swedish conscious in TV shows. You pick up a part here and there, something called Orca Orca. You pick up a couple of episodes.
Directed by Baker, by the way.
Directed by Baker, okay.
Yeah.
So, there's the connection. Lasermannen, you have a role there. And then The December Dream, you end up with a nice arc, 7 episodes.
Yeah.
There. Is that sort of your breakthrough in your mind?
No, I mean, The December Dream was Julkalendern. So, with Alicia Vikander.
Okay. I see a lot of great names in the productions you've been a part of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I can't really say. I mean, a lot of people talk about, oh, that was the big break, but I always feel like there's no exact project that's been like, oh, that's where it happened. There's been a lot of little sort of nudges step by step. So there's no Titanic.
You move into sort of these, starting to move into these sort of classic Swedish titles that you inhabit now. So you are part of this. You're a go-to Swedish actor after, you know, I don't know. After you're in Jonsson Ligan, the reboot there. Yeah. You're in the Arne Dahl series. You're in, what's that other?
Johan Falk.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you do 10 or 12 of those things?
I think 13.
Okay, so then you are part of Swedish culture at that point.
Absolutely. I mean, Johan Falk is the most, I think it's the highest grossing DVD sale in Swedish film history. That's Swedish films or foreign films. That's like, it's ridiculous how big that show is here. So I mean, if I had to pick one, that'd be the Johan Falk would be the sort of thing that tipped it all over the edge. After Johan Falk, someone saw me in that and they called me in for Jonsson Ligan. So from that point, things started
people started chasing you and you chasing them.
Exactly.
Okay, that must be a nice feeling when that starts to
happen.
It's
a wonderful feeling.
How does it feel to get a call for Jonsson Ligan? Okay, that's a Swedish Buskies-esque classic.
Yeah.
You know, that resonates with families all around Sweden. Do you have any reservations thinking, ooh, do I want to take that on? Is that...
No, I never have reservations as far as what are they going to say? Like those kinds of reservations, I rarely have those.
I'm just that it's sort of someone has done it, so there's an expectation rather than having that blank slate.
No, I like that. I mean, everything that's a challenge is a challenge, right? So there's no sort of there's no guide as far as don't do something that someone else has already done. I don't have anything like that. As far as Jonsson Ligan goes, if they wanted us to do Jonsson Ligan the way it's been. So we want you to get as close to your character Von Heden as Ulf Brunberg. I would have said no. That's not interesting. Yeah. But if you want to do something fresh with it, absolutely. Let's throw ourselves into that and see what happens.
You're off and running.
Yeah.
And then you have an interesting career arc here. Then suddenly you start to put your toes in the water, Utumlands again. You pop up as a bartender in a German series.
Yeah.
And then you end up in the UK for an arc in
The Last Weekend
with a really disturbing character. He's an interesting artist. I don't know how to put it.
He's an interesting artist,
He's doing some wacky stuff. I just saw some clips from that, so I really can't speak deeply about it, but I was disturbed by what I saw. I was moved by what I saw, and I was fascinated to think about that actually being real practice for art.
I'm sure it is. I mean, I think it sounded pretty interesting. I mean, he's creating, he's cut himself or he's burned himself and he's connecting electrodes to his heart to monitor the pain and creating sound waves out of that. I could see that happening.
Turning pain into music. That's
exactly.
We already have a method for that. It's called the blues, but okay. If you want to try that, that's fine. You also had a big part in a US series called Tyrant.
Yeah. Yeah.
First of all, is that shot in the U.S.?
No. I've come to realize that people don't shoot stuff in the U.S. anymore. That was shot in, let me see, we shot the first season in Tel Aviv, and then Tel Aviv and Istanbul. Mm-hmm. Season two we shot in Morocco and Budapest, and then season three we shot in Budapest.
Okay, so yeah, the fantasy of filmmaking. What was that, or TV making, what was that experience like to be part of a U.S. production, if for lack of a better term? It's FX, right? Who has that?
It's FX, and Fox 21. It was fantastic. I loved it. I mean, you talk about professionals. These guys know exactly what they're doing. These are the same producers that made Homeland and 24. So they know what they're doing as far as production goes, and they know how to take care of their people, and they know how to make the production roll, especially at the scale that we were working at, I think we're at like $3.5-4 million an episode. So everything was huge. And every week, new actors flew in from all over the world to play. You know, day players came in from all over the world. And it was fantastic. I mean, it was fun, great team, great bunch of actors. Stay in touch still to this day on a daily basis.
How did you get the role?
Well, I auditioned for it a year earlier by self-tape. and didn't hear anything. You know, you send all these self-tapes out into the world. Heard nothing, didn't think of it. And then a year went by and I got this new self-tape. And they're like, it's Tyrant. We need this right away. I was like, ugh, I'm on my way out. I had this thing to do. And I just grabbed my phone. I got the script and I was like, all right, I'm going to cut away all the other lines and I'm going to do it as a monologue. So I did that and just sent it off on my phone. Didn't even edit, didn't do anything. And then that was on a Wednesday. On the day after Thursday, they called and said, can you be in Morocco on Monday? I was like, all right, yeah, sure. I'll fly to Morocco. Flew to Morocco, got there, and people were telling me, they were like, oh, it's a fantastic part. Ihab Rashid, he's this rebel leader, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I don't have a script. I don't have my lines. The dialect coach called me up at the beautiful hotel they had, and she was like, oh, I'm here to work on your lines. I'm like, all right, I don't know what the lines are.
First things first.
Arabic accent, blah, blah. First things first, let's figure out the lines. She's like, no, it's just one line. Who doesn't enjoy fireworks? That's your whole line. I was like, that's it? Yes, that's it for the pilot. I'm like, Jesus. Yeah, that's a great part. I do my line. I went in. I did it. And then from there, it just kind of grew. Like the part for every episode grew. And then they started sort of morphing him into the antagonist of the whole thing. And by season 2 and 3, he's like the main antagonist of the whole show. Start off as a guest star and turn into a series regular by season 2 and season 3. And yeah.
And what does that do for like your recognition factor in the US now? Do people know who you are a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I was in LA just a couple of months ago and absolutely people more and more actually, because people tend not to watch things when they air. Right. Now they binge.
We have the luxury.
Yeah, we have the luxury. So recently, like now that it's shown up and popped up on Netflix and people have started watching it in the US a lot more. It's fun.
Nice. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Which brings us to your latest project, Advokaten.
Advokaten.
And you are the advocate, the lawyer.
I am.
The lawyer.
I am.
Carrying the project. Feel pressure?
I don't. I mean, I don't really get the whole pressure thing. We're actors. And naturally, I feel pressure I'll do all the work. I'll do tons and tons and tons of research, and I won't come unprepared to set, and I'll do all the work basically. But at the end of the day, we're not curing cancer here. We're just making, this is entertainment. If we can teach someone something along the way, fantastic. But it is, we're just trying to be entertaining. If it fails, then nobody dies. You know, the sun will come up tomorrow.
That's a healthy attitude.
Yeah. It's like, I feel a lot more pressure with, you know, how my son's going to do on his math test next week.
I have a couple of questions I want to get into. Yeah. One, you are a father and a husband.
Yeah.
How do you balance, hey, got to be in Morocco on Monday?
Well, that all comes down to, it's easy for me to go to Morocco. more on point is how does my wife do it? Because she's the one who sort of has to, because she's a freelance journalist, so she works at home. But she's the one who has to sort of make everything work while I'm gone. I mean, it's a miracle to me that she manages. She always says, she has a podcast too.
We have to give her a shout out.
Yeah, Den Ultimata Föräldra Podden.
There you go.
Yeah, Olga Akolor. She has it with Olga Akolor, who has a husband, Kodjo Akolor, who's also in the entertainment business. So they're both sort of every now and then left to take care of everything. Yeah, and so they can commiserate and talk about that whole thing. And I mean, it's rough. But at the same time, nowadays I have a clause in all the contracts for stuff that's being shot in interesting places. Like I shot this American movie called Double Play with Ernest Dickerson. And it was the lead, so I knew I had to be on set all the time. But it was shooting in Curaçao, so I knew I couldn't go back and forth. So I just said, listen, I want you to tell my agents that they can, whatever they want to do as far as pay goes, that's up to them. Whatever they think is fair is fair. But I want 5 tickets and a large place to stay, like a big hotel room, so we can all fit. And I'm bringing them all. So we'll stay, we'll go to Curacao for 2 months, and then we'll go to, we were in Tel Aviv, we were in Budapest, we were in LA, we've been.
Are your kids old enough to be appreciating this and enjoying it?
They are. I mean, they still talk about Curacao. Not the youngest, the youngest one's three, so he hasn't really, I think he remembers LA. But the other ones definitely, they want to move to every place we've been.
You're creating the next generation of talent. I can see what's happening.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You talk about being prepared on set as part of my preparation. I've been listening to a couple of other your interviews. I think you have a real interesting method where you like to record the complete script on your phone and listen to it over and over again to get into the story, the character. Why have you chosen this method?
Well, it started with something that I heard in an interview with Anthony Hopkins many, many years ago. And he said he used to read the script every day from page to page, cover to cover. And I just thought, well, that's really cool. And I started trying to do that. And I hate reading scripts. I mean, scripts are boring.
Hang on. What's your job?
I know. I'm aware. but scripts are not like books. They're not entertainingly written.
No.
They're blueprints for something else. It's like reading a map, really. And so the entertainment value is not there in the script, oftentimes. But I really wanted to try this, just to read it over and over and over and over again. So I decided, let me record it. And so I did that, and I realized that by recording it, I can listen to it more times than I could ever read it in one day. Because you can't very well read it while you're walking or exercising or
in the car or whatever.
In the car, yeah. And also another interesting factor of that is that I can read it if you've been out having dinner and you had a few glasses of wine, you're going to listen to it with other ears than you did at the gym. And also I turn it on my headphones when I go to bed, and I put on repeat, so it's in my ears all night.
So subliminally influencing you somehow.
Yeah. And a lot of times I'll wake up at night and I'll be like, whoa, and I'll email the director. And
Do you find these things infecting your dreams?
Yes, which is really cool that you could dream scenes out of the project that you're going to do, which is really, really interesting to me.
Are they ever anything like the final scenes that you actually shoot, or are they just...
Well, they're definitely... Stuff does change. I mean, if I've read it and I thought, all right, this is what this scene is going to be, and then something woke me up in the middle of the night, and I'm like, no, this is what... And I've actually changed ideas and thoughts that I've had, or realized things about the character, or, you know.
All right, let's get into Advocaten a little bit, some of this specifically. Are you guys finished with the whole first season? Are you still shooting?
No, we're all done. We're all done. We've got some ADR left, and then we're all good to go.
And so how many episodes do we have for season
10. One?
10 episodes. Okay, yeah. I've been through 4.
Right.
And I'm fascinated by your character.
Wonderful.
It goes from 0 to 60 like this.
Yeah.
To give people a little background, you... and your sister are separated as young children after the murder of your parents.
Right.
And then 20 years later, you come back together because your sister is on the case.
Right.
She has a lead. She thinks she knows who's responsible.
Right.
And it turns out it's someone who you end up working for the law firm that represents them.
Yeah.
Because you want to get close to them. But your character goes from this straight arrow by the book guy,
right?
Really just clean and above board in every way, to a by any means necessary to get close to this gangster lawyer.
Yeah.
And that is a fascinating transition.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your relationship to sort of the law? Have you been in trouble? Have you studied the law? Have you been on either side of this in real life?
No, I mean, I've been pretty clean all my life.
I don't mean anything by that.
No, I know. I've been fairly good all my life. But I've always been fascinated by the law. I applied to go to the police academy here in Sweden 5 years ago. Not to become a police officer, just to get the education of a police
officer.
The
criminal justice part of it.
Just to become a trained police officer and then go on being an actor. And you can do that, on by just
audit the course without having to go for the final degree and all that stuff.
No. It's you don't have to be at the school. You could do
a distance. Okay.
Distance, yeah. And still become a fully fledged police officer. Now, that didn't pan out because I had to go off and play a police officer, so it didn't work. But I've always been fascinated with law and the judicial system and so in preparation for the lawyer, I dropped my kids off at school and daycare, and then I'd go to the courthouse and I would sit there from early morning until evening watching criminal cases every day for 3.5 months, hours and hours, hundreds of hours of cases that I'd see and follow from beginning to end. Everything from murders to, shoplifting, which is I'm just fascinated by it. I learned tons.
Did you see a sense of performance among some of these lawyers who were presenting their cases?
Are they? Oh, Jesus Christ! Yes. Oh my Lord! I mean, they're actors. Not only are they actors when they speak. Opening statements and closing statements and all that kind of stuff. But they're also actors when they just sit. There's an act to how much do you look at the prosecutor while they're talking? If you look at them too much, it might seem like they're making a good point. If you're just scribbling in your notebook, it's like, this isn't even touching me. This is nothing. This is, you know what I mean? There's acting to every single part of it. And also, I mean, in the lawyer, the opening scene when I'm in court, we wanted to have a good case. We wanted to have something to show that he's a good lawyer, but we couldn't put it in Sweden because in Sweden we don't have a jury.
I think it's interesting how it crosses Öresund, the story, by the way, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah. I mean, if we put it in Denmark, there's a jury and you could speak to their emotions because they're regular people.
That classic courtroom drama.
Exactly. Right. In Sweden, you've got bureaucrats sitting in, so it doesn't really work that way. It's not as dramatic.
So that was one of the reasons for making it a production that crossed the border? To allow for that?
No, I think the main reason for that was money.
Money, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a co-production, Denmark-Sweden, which is a good thing. It's the same thing with, you watch these American shows now, and if you know that it's cheaper to shoot in, say, Budapest, right? The nature of the show itself is going to change, and the nature of what TV looks like changes. Yeah. I mean, everyone loves to see New York on film.
But New York became Toronto. And
New York became Toronto, yeah. Everyone loves to see New York, but if you have to shoot in Milwaukee, you can't write the movie Manhattan. You have to figure out what stories. All of a sudden, you've got 3 billboards outside of Missouri. What's that? Yeah, the movie. So I love the idea of this sort of crossing over and spreading out.
I think it reflects our real life somehow as well. I mean, if you live in Skåne, you live across Öresund, you're going to work or, coming to Copenhagen from Malmo, whatever.
And also, you've got a whole new pool of actors, all these Danish actors that came in. I mean, Thomas Bolarsson's a legend, and Nikolai Copernicus, and all these guys who came in just gives it another tone.
And Nikolai plays your boss.
Yeah.
He comes back to you talking about all these, your presence as a lawyer. I like the way he's always playing with your character. He's always sort of grabbing a lapel or
touching an earlobe.
Touching it. That was very.
The hell?
My wife and I both stopped on that. Wait, what? That was very.
I know. We had different levels of reactions on the earlobe. We're like, touch his earlobe. Baker actually directed that scene. He's like, let me touch his earlobe. And we were trying to figure out, well, how big of a reaction do we want? We can't make the scene about the earlobe. but he sells it. He's got such warmth that...
It's something about his power. Yeah. It really establishes sort of the relationship between those two characters early on. My wife and I were both arrested by that. Whoa, what happened there?
Yeah.
Nice choice by your brother. when you got on board this project...
Yeah.
You have Jens Lapidus behind it.
Oh, yeah.
You have Michael Hjort. You have
Hans Rosenthal,
who's responsible for Bruin. So you have a really super team.
Oh, yeah.
Already in place when it starts. So expectations are high coming in across the board.
They are. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I so wanted this project.
I heard you say it was a dream role for you.
It was a dream role. I mean, it was such a dream. Like I said, actors, we just throw out auditions left, right, and center. And we don't really know where they're going to land or who's going to offer what. But with The Lawyer, I'd actually said in an interview right after Tyra and I, they asked me, what do you want to do next? And I said, I'd love to like play a lawyer. And I, because I'd been wearing these boots and military.
Get me out of the mud.
Yeah, get me out of the mud. I was like, I want to play a lawyer with suits and nice floors and just courtrooms. And the 3 days later, they hadn't heard the interview. It just came down like manna from heaven. They just, 3 days later, they called, hey, we have this show called The Lawyer. Would you want to come in and audition for it? And I went in. And I loved it so much that after I'd prepared the audition, because it's not only the three gentlemen you mentioned, but it's also Niklas, Wikström Nicastro, the producer, and Joachim Hansson. And I'd worked with both of them on Johan Falk and Jönssonligan and loved them. I just love working for them. And I did the audition, prepared like a madman. We did the audition. I went home. I went to Baker. I was like, listen, I got to go that extra mile to get this part. So we went out and shot a short movie, The Lawyer, based on the audition material that I had. We went to law offices. I got all dressed up. We shot shots of me on the street and with the dialogue and the just all kinds of stuff. And we were going to, you know, we did the color correction on it and the sound editing, and we were going to send it in and be like, come on, guys. I mean, I'm The Lawyer. Come on, give me the part. But before we had a chance to finish it, they already offered the part.
Man, I'm really impressed by your level of ambition, and I like the way you're on it together as a family. That's cool. That's a really cool story behind it. Your brother directed a couple of episodes. Are you a package deal these days?
I want us to be. No, he actually, because I really wanted him to direct it. Because this is something, we just love working together. But by that time, they had already chosen the director. The director's been on for years and years. Geir Henning Hopland, but I'd already told the producers, I was like, oh, come on, let's do it this way. Once I had the part, and then they were like, oh, sorry, we already picked the director, but a few months pass and we need to go down and do some extra stuff, some second unit stuff. And they're like, I mean, we've got the second unit directing thing if you want to. And I was like, yeah, ask him, please. And I convinced him to like, do it, just do it. We'll get to do a little bit together.
I don't want to reveal anything, but did you guys shoot any of that second unit stuff in Stockholm?
No, we shot it all in Skåne, Copenhagen.
Okay, I know there are a couple exterior shots in Stockholm that are supposed to be called Skåne.
Really?
I won't go into. But again, I really like the way sort of you're covering sort of the characters. You know, you and Malin are both playing these very layered characters. Malin has her demons.
You know,
the police, the narcotic police who's got her addictions and all that stuff. You, a character who's making this transition from this sort of upright life to an unexpected chase into this dark world.
Yeah.
Talked about some of the Danish actors who are part of it. The women in this are amazing. You play opposite Malin, who obviously is, you know, having her moment. In the first four episodes, you have, is it Liv Munoz?
Mjönes.
Mjönes, who plays also sort of a professional and personal friend to your character, who pays a price, I guess, for that friendship.
Yeah.
But some really great performances across the board. Every time
Absolutely.
You turn, when you move from the courtroom to the privacy of a cabin to the underworld and smoothly through all of those that are very different worlds, and then they come together and sort of, I get the sense of the law as a filter, kind of hiding, not necessarily protecting, but hiding us from this darkness that's going
on.
And your character navigating this is just amazing. How challenging is it to sort of, okay, you have the guy, he's this upright guy, but in 30 seconds, he's going to make the transition. How do you do that as an actor?
I don't think it's two different roles.
Yeah,
but I always look at it like he's not really an upright guy. He is what he is, but he's hiding it behind a veneer of being upright. That's why he's so correct. I mean, and anybody who's normal would say, all right, the bottle of whiskey that he gets offered in the first would just say, screw it, give me the bottle. Right.
No, he's making his point there. 350 and over, cut it.
Yeah, that's a bribe. Because he's trying so hard to not crack. I mean, I look at Frank as somebody who he never eats a good meal. He never has a good meal of food. He never sits and has a bottle of wine.
Enjoys it.
He eats because he has to live. He eats to live. That's why I always want. I also want him to be thinner than I am. I want him to be sort of thin and sort of. He never has music playing in the background in his apartment. He never watches TV or plays an instrument. He never cooks.
There's no joy.
There's no joy. There's no light. All he does is sit with his computer and work, and then he goes to work. Even when he works out, he's not like joking around with the guys.
It's frustration coming out.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he battles his demons just like his sister does, but they've just chosen two different paths, two different MOs, basically.
So maybe this is some truth about who he is emerging in
exactly.
the later character.
Exactly.
Fascinating. I'm really looking forward to see where this takes us, and I hope there'll be a season two. I hope you guys don't end this after 10 episodes, because I'm hooked.
I don't think
I'm hooked after four. What else are you working on?
Well, I naturally, there's the secret projects that one cannot, must not, shan't speak of. But also, I'm actually a writer these days. I wrote a book.
A book. What's the topic?
It's a suspense thriller sort of thing. Not at all like this. It was supposed to be. I've written a lot of scripts in my day, to short films, features, and TV series. And I was gonna write. I got this idea for a feature, with myself in the lead, as I always.
But that
I mean, as always when I write.
But this is, I think, part of being a modern actor / creator.
Yeah.
You have to take a broader responsibility.
You do. Yeah. Absolutely. But then as I was sitting there, I was in Budapest and I had all this time on my hands, and I was like, all right, well, I'm not going to write it as a script, because then I've got to deal with producers and blah. I'll just write it as a book. And I started, and a year later it was done, 400 pages. And I was naive. I knew nothing of the book industry. But I've seen books on bookshelves. They all got published. I have read one or two in my day. And I thought, books get published. So I sent it to the biggest publishing house. I had the two big ones, Bonnier and Neustadt. I chose Neustadt. I was like, I'll send it to them. They'll probably publish it. It took a month. I was like, what's taking them so long to decide to publish my book? Don't they know who I think I am? I just thought it was a good book. I was like, publish it. I Googled to check, like, what's the ratio of all the books they get sent. It turns out the ratio is they get 2,000 books and they accept somewhere between 0 and 2 books a year. I was like, oh, my Jesus. Maybe I should find a backup plan. I started looking for others. But then I got the call.
About the same odds as getting the lead in something like Advokaten.
Exactly. But then I got the call from Neustadt, and they loved it and they want to publish it, and we signed and so now that's coming out, and also it's being worked on to translate to feature.
I assume there's an arc here. We'll see the book, then we'll get the option.
Indeed.
And you'll be producing it with your brother directing it.
Sounds
and you'll
good.
Be starring
I won't
it.
Be producing it, though.
Okay.
I'm hoping for the producers of this.
Aha,
yeah,
smart,
yeah, we're
smart,
talking.
Smart. Can I ask you the difference between working on sort of something like the American production, where you're in Budapest, you say, $3 million an episode, everything that you need there, versus working on a Scandinavian production? What's the difference?
Nothing really. I mean, obviously, Americans have, you get paid more.
Scale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's really the same thing. I mean, what it all comes down to is, you're going to stand in front of somewhere between 30 to, if you're in Sweden, you've got maybe 30 people. If you're in this, 30 to 50 people, and there you've got maybe 100 people and a bunch of producers and stuff like that.
So just more specialist on
just a lot more, and a lot more producers, people from different, you know. But then at the what it all boils down to is someone's going to yell, quiet, roll sound, camera's going to point at you. They have one or two cameras, never more, and then action. And you just got to do what you do. And it's really just the same thing wherever you are.
When it comes to the performance.
Yeah, it's just the same thing. I don't feel any more pressure working there.
Yeah. Other people have said similar things, that okay, there maybe the trailer has some more stuff in it, whatever. But when the work, when the time
comes
to the work,
yeah.
That's the difference. Can I ask you? We didn't mention Dying of the Light.
Right, right.
Which you're in with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
And I find this fascinating. I don't know how many other people are interested in things like that, but how that's a project that's the vision of an actor and a writer-director.
Right.
That in America has too many producers perhaps involved.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, becomes something that wasn't the vision of the original creators.
Right.
You know,
right.
Was it Brett Ratner who came in?
Came in later?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Where people who are not creative come in and decide that they have to have some influence and take something out of someone's hands.
Yeah.
I don't feel that happening in this market, or I don't hear those stories as commonly as I do from the States.
Yeah. Well, there's a difference between, I mean, in
the
States.
I don't know if that made any sense to anyone who's listening, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I see. I know. Yeah, it made sense to me.
Okay.
I mean, in the case of Dying of the Light, the problem was that Paul Schrader, one of my big idols, wrote and directed the movie. And once he was done and the edit, he handed in his edit with Niklas Winding Refn, great Danish director. The script that he had written was pure Paul Schrader. I mean, he wrote Taxi Driver, co-wrote Raging Bull.
And anything we've heard of?
and this was just, he'd spent 7 years writing the script. It was beautiful. I loved it. But then they didn't like it. They thought it was too artsy. It was the script that he'd actually handed in. But they took it away from him because he didn't have final cut. And they re-edited it. They cut away all the sort of good parts, and they turned it into something that it definitely wasn't. You can't even recognize the script from the if you watch the movie. But I don't know if they brought in another director. But the problem was that they just took it from him, and then that was that. Then he tried to get it. Then he said, "All right, well, now after years and years after, he said, well, what if I take the give me the material? Let me re-edit it." I'll give you all the money. All the proceeds will go to you.
I just want my vision to get at least come to life.
Exactly. And Lionsgate, who had the ownership of it, said yes. But Grindstone, their VOD place, said no because of, you know.
It's already out, blah, blah, blah.
So he didn't get to do that. He did it anyway, I think, just with the material that was there.
How does that feel as a performer? You know, you're at the whims of sort of these different forces.
I mean, it's tough, but it's a lot tougher for someone like Paul. I mean, that's his vision, 7 years. For us, for me and Cage and Anton Yelchin, who was in it, for us, we'll just go on and do another movie. But for someone like that, he's poured his heart and soul into it, and he was there for the whole financing, and we just got a script, basically, and... Yeah, you want to do this? Yeah. Really.
But if it's his vision, and it might have resonated differently, and that might have meant something for your career. If it,
absolutely.
Been treated as he had intended.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we still, I spoke to him just yesterday, Paul, and I mean, he's absolutely, but I feel more sorry for him than for anybody else. And the difference between there and here is, since you do have the option of getting final cut, in the States. In Sweden, you can't negotiate that away from your deal as a director.
You're protected.
You're completely protected. You cannot enter a deal where you say, all right, well, if you have final cut, then, you know, where you just...
Is that praxis or is it legislated? How's that controlled? I love that.
It's by the union. So it's in the sort of, you know, contract of the union that directors have final cut, period.
I wasn't aware of that. That's a significant difference.
Yeah, on features. I really don't know what it's like on TV, because TV directors is not... it's not the same job, really.
Different thing. Do you prefer TV over film or vice versa?
I love them both. I had a hard time with TV first season of Tyrant because there's no prep time. You get the script 5 days later, you're on set to shoot that scene that you just got.
Wait a minute, I have to listen to this.
I've only heard it 70 times. I've only had 5 days. But then what you learn is that you get time to, once you've found the character, you get that time to sort of like reevaluate the character. So that show started airing before we'd finished shooting. So we were shooting episode 6 and they started airing episode 1. And you get comments from the world. People are saying, you know, oh, I don't understand what Ehab is saying, my character, or whatever. Then I can sort of make that a little bit better. You could tweak. And then also, once you finished one season, like with Advocaten, if people don't like Frank in Advocaten season one for this or that reason, we can take that into consideration when we go into season two and we can try to make amends.
I don't know if I like him, but I'm fascinated by him so far.
Exactly. But I mean, as far as TV, if movies go, it's like you shoot a movie. When you're done, you're done. There's no going back. There's no end changing it.
It is what it is. Much more risk. Or I guess everything is at stake there.
Yeah.
Have you done any theater? Is that part of your background?
Tons, yeah. I mean, I started off in theater and I did in Malmö, at the Stadstheater, Helsingborg Stadstheater, and I'm doing theater again this year.
Oh, what are you working on?
Shakespeare in Love.
Shakespeare in Love, nice.
End of the year, yeah, I'll be at Stockholm Stadstheater.
Oh, excellent. When does that go off?
Main stage. We start rehearsing August 15th, and then we go until December 31st. It's going to be fun. I'm Will, playing Will Shakespeare.
All right.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
I bet. That's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
But okay, I think we should wrap it up here.
Yep.
This has been great talking to you. Thanks again for taking the time. I know you've been at it all day, so
it's
we appreciate
fun.
This.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us,
Thanks
Alexander
so much,
Kareem. Thanks again for joining us. I hope you enjoyed hearing Alexander's story as much as I did talking with him. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend to tune in, or take a moment to rate us or give us a few stars wherever you find your podcasts. If you want to reach out, you can find us on Twitter at StreamCloseUp. We're always happy to hear from you, and if you have any ideas about who you'd like to hear up here for their Stream Close-Up in the future, let us know. As always, we want to thank the good people at I Like Radio for giving us a home.